Librarian Nancy Pearl stops by from time to time with some recommended reading for us, and today she has a list of what she calls mysteries we might have missed. Welcome back, Nancy.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
And you've sent me this gigantic stack of books. Which one should I pick first?
Oh, that green one.
Okay, here we go. The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie by Alan Bradley.
Well, this is a classic, one of those classic British mysteries, just published in 2009, but it's set in the early 1950s in a country house in England. And a young 11-year-old, our 11-year-old heroine, Flavia Deluce, is a chemistry fanatic. And so as you're reading this book and reading about the mystery, one of the side pleasures of this book is learning about all the chemistry heroes that we probably maybe learned in 10th grade chemistry but have forgotten. Now, Flavia wakes up one morning and looks out the window and sees a man lying in the kitchen garden. She goes outside. The man is dying. His last words are in Latin, but Flavia, being a brilliant little girl,
naturally
understands them.
Knows Latin.
And,
it, 11.
And
okay.
She says, and the man is saying, farewell. And the local constable has plans to arrest Flavia's father, and Flavia, of course, does not believe her father is guilty of murder, so she determines that she is going to figure out who killed this man. Now, this involves many trips to the village by bicycle, which I just love. And at one point, Flavia gets herself in a very tight spot with the man who she really has determined is the real murderer, and she knows that he's lying to her. And this is a quote from the book. It was a lie, and I detected it at once. As an accomplished fibber myself, I spotted the telltale signs of an untruth before they were halfway out of his mouth. The excessive detail, the offhand delivery, and the wrapping up of it all in casual chit-chat. Doesn't that make Flavia sound great?
Right. Another book from your pile here is The Case of the Gilded Fly by Edmund Crispin.
Edmund Crispin is a pseudonym for a composer named Bruce Montgomery. And this is a book that has just been republished by a small company called Felony and Mayhem, who are bringing out, I'm so thrilled, bringing out the classic books of the past. And this is a book written in the 1950s, I believe, that really echoes the golden age of British fiction. This is a true puzzle.
We don't get 1945.
Yes.
Right, go ahead.
We don't get true puzzles the way we used to get in the days of Agatha Christie or Dorothy Sayers. What we get now are more thrillers and more action-oriented things. But the main character in this book is a professor of English named Gervase Fenn. And this is one of those classic books which assembles a large cast of characters, mm-hmm. several of whom are going to be murdered, and only one person, in this case Gervase Fenn, can figure out who's guilty. The wonderful thing about these books is that the author plays absolutely fair with the reader, so that you have all the clues right there, but they're so covered over by red herrings and other devious means of, I'm convinced, punctuation that we miss, something like that. You would have a difficult time. One would have a difficult time.
Oh, I would have a difficult time. I have no doubt.
And I have a difficult time figuring out who really done it.
Punctuation.
I just made that up. Oh, I'm sure okay. It's not punctuation. I'm sure it's just red herrings.
All right. Well, let's keep moving on through the stack here. China. Well, how do you pronounce it?
China Mieville.
Oh, China Mieville. Okay. It's called The City and the City.
The City and the City. Oh, my gosh.
Now, this is one that gets a little strange.
Yes. This is one of those books that takes a little work, but it repays you in the end. It is an absolutely stunning mystery that's set in twin cities. These are twin cities that occupy the same physical space.
Parallel universe?
They're not even parallel. They're just right one on top of each other. And the only way that they can, that pretense or the existence of the cities can continue is if you, living in one of those cities, ignore the presence of the other city.
Hmm.
Isn't that amazing? And then a young woman is killed and an inspector is charged with finding who the murderer is. And in doing so, he has to travel between cities. And it turns out that this young woman is part of this kind of offbeat, illegal group that believes that, in fact, there are three cities. Mm. And one of those three cities exists in the in between the other two.
You know, as strange as this sounds, it makes me think of my own neighborhood in Washington, D.C., where there's a certain kind of person of a certain age with a certain type of family out on the street during the day,
right.
and then late at
right.
night, a very different kind of people at the bars and so forth.
And I think you can't help but read this book without thinking about real places. I mean, when I was reading this, I thought about the Middle East a lot. I thought about the former Czechoslovakia. I thought about how the world segregates itself, and that segregation is really a willingness to displace what you see in front of you.
People live in the same place but inhabit almost different worlds.
Totally.
Wow.
And it all works as a mystery, which is the most amazing thing.
What about the world of Elliot Patterson, the Skull Mantra?
Well, you pick one in which the main character in this book is actually Tibet.
Okay.
And this is a Tibet trying to free itself from Chinese overrule.
All right.
And the main character in this book is a Chinese named Inspector Shan, who is sent as punishment. I used to work for one of the government ministries in China. To Tibet to kind of teach him a lesson. And he begins to learn from the dissident monks who are also there for a kind of a punishment. Then, of course, a murder occurs and Shan is asked to investigate. And the thing about this book that makes this book so wonderful and that makes me love reading so much is that in any kind of book that you read, you learn something. And when you finish this book, you know so much about Tibet, and you have such respect for the monks who are living their beliefs despite physical hardships.
Mm.
And you also have a real respect for this Inspector Shan, who is going to risk certainly increased comforts, more food, better housing, all those sorts of things, to follow his own conscience. It's a wonderful, wonderful novel.
Well, Nancy Pearl, good to see you again.
Thank you.
When you're checking the headlines throughout this day,
so how often can you call up a character from a book you're reading?
Hey, this is Zach Taylor. I'm sorry I've been so hard to get a hold of lately. This Martin Grace case is haunting me in unexpected ways.
That is the voicemail of Zach Taylor, the protagonist in a psycho-thriller novel called Personal Effects Dark Art. The novel follows the case of a blind psychic serial killer. But when you open the cover, you find that there's a lot more than just a book inside. You've got case files, birth certificates, insurance cards, even the killer's state ID card. It all comes with the book, along with phone numbers to call and websites you can visit. And this is all part of an effort to take the reader inside the case and much deeper into the lives of its characters. Joining me now to talk about this book are the two men behind it. J.C. Hutchins is with us from member station WLRN in Miami, Florida. J.C., how are you?
Hey there, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. And also Jordan Weissman is joining us from WFYI in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to you, Jordan.
Good morning.
You know, I opened the book here, and in the front cover, there's a pouch. And I mean, the stuff that comes along with it, I mean, like, it's, you know, death certificates and ID cards and stuff with phone numbers. I mean, it just piques your curiosity immediately. What is the point? What are you going for with giving us all these extra accoutrements?
Well, the concept was to take a story and use the same communication technologies that we interact with our real lives to interact with fiction. And kind of recalling that period or a situation where you pick up a wallet on the street and you want to do the good thing. You want to return it to the person who lost it. But you feel kind of dirty just looking through it, because there's nothing more voyeuristic than looking through someone's pockets or through their wallet. And I wanted to
Well, as one of your readers,
that.
Thank you for making me seem voyeuristic. I really appreciate that. I felt like sort of a weirdo.
Well, but there's a lot of energy in that feeling, right? That because all of a sudden,
recall,
these characters aren't remote, right? These characters are much more real now because they're in your world. You're holding the contents of their wallet in your hand. You can call them on the phone. You can email them and get responses. You know, you're in the same world they are, and it makes the story much more immediate.
J.C. Hutchins, you did the writing, and let's stick to the words for just a moment. A passage sort of struck me on page 41. We're in the mental hospital. Zach Taylor is sort of treating someone who's a prisoner. Kind of set the scene for us, if you can. Introduce us to the characters.
Well, Zach Taylor is a young and optimistic art therapist working at Brinkvale Psychiatric, this hopeless mental institution in New York State. The building wasn't built up like most buildings, where it was built down into an abandoned brownstone quarry. And here, Zach Taylor is meeting, probably for the first time, Martin Grace, his psychosomatically blind patient, who is a suspected serial killer.
And Martin Grace actually speaks to Zach Taylor, and I think we have an actor reading some of what the patient tells the therapist here.
"I can't see you, Mr. Taylor, but I already know you," Martin Grace said. "I smelled the stink of fear when you opened that door. Just look at you in your youth, in your oh-so-comfortable clothes, your baggy jeans, your button-down shirt, hanging over an undoubtedly very trendy T-shirt, and your old wind-up watch. An heirloom from a dead relative."
Okay, so that's Martin Grace, the patient, sort of freaking out the therapist. Zach Taylor, I'm sort of feeling signs of the lambs here. I mean, Clarice talking to Hannibal Lecter.
Well, it was certainly an inspiration, no doubt. I think that the fundamental difference that we wanted to bring to Martin was that, unlike Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, who is giving Clarice a lot of helpful information about the case that she's working on, Martin Grace doesn't want help at all. So he is, you know, doing everything he can to shove Zach Taylor away. And that particular scene, I mean, Zach Taylor comes away kind of reeling and completely at a loss.
And Jordan, you actually take the world well beyond this story. I mean, I was fascinated. You know, there are a lot of websites and blogs that you can go to. And do you guys feel like that gives readers something more? I mean, adds to the experience?
I think it does, because the reading of the book is a vicarious experience. And then there's a subtle transition into a first-person experience, into where you're now going to take on the detective role yourself and solve things that our protagonist, Zachary Taylor, didn't solve. His goal is not to solve the crime. His goal is to help his patient. If the reader wants to push forward beyond the book into all of this transmedia content, they can solve the crime.
So can you guys tell me how to solve it? You want to just point me to the silver bullet here? I need to figure out how to solve this thing. Thank you guys for talking about this.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to J.C. Hutchins, who is joining us from member station WLRN in Miami, and his co-author, Jordan Weissman, who was with us from WFYI in Indianapolis. And their new book is Personal Effects Dark Art. Just be sure to read it with the lights on.
News about some compelling reading is spreading by word of mouth. The mouth in question belongs to Tina Brown. She's editor of a website called The Daily Beast, and she's also the former editor of magazines like Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. She's an omnivorous reader of articles and stories from all over, so this summer we've been asking what she's reading. The last time we spoke, you had sent us an article about writers who drink, who abuse substances, and I asked you if, as an editor, you preferred to work with people like that. You actually said yes, and now you've sent us an article about Annie Leibovitz, the famous photographer who used to work for you.
Indeed, yes. This current New York magazine has a big piece about Annie's big financial problems that she's in at the moment. Annie's $24 million in debt, which is pretty extraordinary when you consider it. But, you know, of course, I'm a great fan of Annie's. You know, working with her as I did at Vanity Fair, a lot of her problems really stem from her extraordinary perfectionism. This is a person who just wants to only focus on her work, to drill down to the very best picture. And she really will do anything it takes, whether it means flying people around the country or going into overtime or, you know, bringing people to the set or redoing the set or redoing the whole thing three times. She just doesn't really care, as long as she gets her picture. And, of course, that has often led her into a huge overtime and a great deal of financial issues, which we're now seeing coming to roost now.
Although we should emphasize, she was spending your money when she did that.
Well, you know, I mean, I used to have to get a grip on her, and it was hard.
It sounds like from this article, the descriptions given in this New York Magazine article, that in her earlier life, Annie Leibovitz was relatively modest in her personal spending, her personal circumstances, except for a drug habit, but lived in a modest apartment, and that changed in recent years, which is part of her trouble now.
It did, and I think it was all part of the kind of borrowing on the Never Never madness that everybody got into. I mean, Annie's a zeitgeist creature herself, and in a way, everything that's happened to her reflects the zeitgeist in which she's lived. I mean, she moved in a world of celebrity. She became the lover of Susan Sontag, the famous critic. She mixed with movie stars and rock stars and so forth. And after a time, that lifestyle starts to rub off. But I will say that I don't fear for Annie in the long run. She's a superb talent, and she's not really a person. She's not a Michael Jackson figure who wants to go off and live the life of craziness. She actually is a woman of simple taste. It's just that things got out of hand.
Buying two townhouses in Greenwich Village, spending millions of dollars renovating, and then having a terrible construction accident that added even more to that. Yeah, that's
indeed
out of hand. And some other trouble as well. I mean, lots of expenses to deal with.
Yeah, there. She did. She really did get out of hand. And, you know, unfortunately, she felt it would go on forever, the big ad contracts and the big American Express deals. And, of course, now the economy collapsed and a lot of those big deals are not there anymore.
This is maybe my favorite detail in the whole thing, that American Express wanted her at one point to endorse their card, and her credit had actually been so bad over the years they'd denied her the card.
That sounds like our Annie, absolutely.
So we have this person who is an obsessive perfectionist when it comes to photography, and then you send me this other article on your reading list, which is also about a different kind of obsessive personality, an article in The New Yorker from a couple of years ago about Asperger's syndrome.
Which has just become a new book, actually, called Parallel Play by Tim Page. It speaks very much to my heart because I have an Asperger's boy myself, George, who is now 23, 24. So I know what it's like to raise an Asperger's child. And this piece, which describes the isolation and the lack of kind of social ability to read clues and so forth, really spoke to what I have dealt with in my son, who is both so adorable in so many ways and yet in other ways just cannot really at times read the room in ways that anyone can who is raised, you know, without this affliction. For instance, my son might once said to somebody, "You could use a facelift."
Could they have used a facelift?
It was all true. And, you know, one of the things that was funny about it is how do you explain to somebody, you know, you're speaking the truth, but you can't speak the truth, darling. So I found this piece and this book now by Paige, you know, an extraordinarily moving account, really, from the inside of what it is like to feel pretty isolated, really, at times from the world and from the signals that it gives each other. It's not easy being these kids.
You have also sent us an article by the conservative writer Peggy Noonan, who seems to be obsessing about politics.
Yes, Peggy Noonan is one of my favorite conservative writers, actually. Peggy's a really a good and thoughtful writer, and she's not a kind of unfair writer either. She has a point of view, but she's very wise. And she's concerned about Obama. She says, you know, he never seems to be leveling these days, only talking. And she kind of feels that this healthcare thing has gone wildly off track for him. She says that, you know, in a way, it's done something that no one could have expected. It's actually united the Republican Party because he hasn't had a clear vision. He hasn't had a clear point of view that he's been able to sell, instead of which he's overwhelmed everybody with too much at once. Actually, we had a good piece as well on the Daily Beast by Connors Friedendorf, which did also take issue with this and said, don't try to do everything at once.
In addition to some of the periodicals that you've sent us and you've been sending us, you've sent along a novel this time, or recommended a novel, Let the Great World Spin.
By Colm McCann, the brilliant, brilliant young Irish writer who's actually teaches English now at Hunter College in New York. This is an absolutely fascinating sort of poetic but gritty account of life in New York during the 70s. And it has a wonderful binding motif, which is the high wire walk of Pettit, who I think there was a movie made out of his antics where he walked between the two towers of the World Trade Center. There are four or five stories in this book, but they're all bound together by that summer day where they looked up and saw Pettit walking on that high wire as a kind of moment of a sort of still point in a turning world. Because that time of the 70s was a time of roughness and terrible recession in New York. New York was bankrupt. It was grimy. And so you have the stories of a young Irish priest working in the projects. You have the story of a hooker that he administers to from her point of view. You have the story of a wife who finds that her son has died in Vietnam. And you have the story of the nurse that the Irish priest was in love with. And they're all linked together. It's a bit like the movie Crash, but done from the point of view of New York in the 70s. I absolutely found it gripping.
Does it feel resonant in this time, given the economic situation in New York?
I mean, I have to say that it does feel a little bit as if we're heading that direction. When I read the story of Annie Leibovitz's excess and bankruptcy, and it feels like everywhere you turn, there is a story about somebody going broke.
Tina Brown, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Word of mouth from Tina Brown, editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast. And when you check the news headlines throughout the day at npr.org, you can also find links to the articles that Tina Brown discussed.